We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Eli, my man. We got some football knowledge in the house right now. Let's go.
He's got some Spurs on his wall in the National Hockey League.
I just wanted to make sure I can get the picture out, let people know that Big Ant Heron is in the house here with me for the next hour. We're going to make this like a regular thing now that baseball season is over. And it's so funny.
Those darn Cubs out of the way.
Yeah. It's so funny because Anthony and I, Mitch put this together and he had decided, hey, let's have Anthony on. And I said, yes, absolutely. I love talking football with Anthony. And Anthony's like, so when am I going to be on the show? And I'm like, well, we have half hour shows until the Cubs are over.
Like, are we doing this? So, or was that being teased?
No.
Was that what's going on?
I didn't want you to have to make the drive down right. If it was only going to be a 22-minute segment. Like, right. That didn't make any sense to me.
And I mean, once it got to the point where the football season began and I wasn't kind of in the regular kind of fill-in or guest host rotation and whatnot, or, you know, you were here on a more regular basis, so me and Shep aren't coming in on Thursdays or whatever our kind of normal Lawrence-y fill-in slot would be if we were here on a weekday, then I wasn't necessarily listening to the radio. So it just wasn't even clicking in my head that, oh, yeah, Lawrence isn't really even on that much because most of the Cubs games are taking place at night right now. So yep. When I'm either, you know, watching on TV or just following a score, if I'm on the road somewhere and I'm thinking, well, yeah, we haven't really like set any evening time slots or when's this regular thing going to happen that we're supposedly going to start doing. So I just wanted to pose the question. So is this real?
Yeah,
it's not you catfishing me.
No, yeah, it's not you. We definitely wanted you to be on the show. We just wanted to make
it wasn't a whole lot of show.
Right, there wasn't enough show to justify bringing you down from the burbs and making you drive 2 hours in traffic to come talk football with us. But I'm glad that you're here now. I love the work that you do. You also do a post-game show. I'm not going to knock it this time. You do the official post-game show on Fox 32 after the game is over. I saw you guys. I was leaving work, and I was laughing because I walked past some screens, and we had just gotten off the air.
Okay.
I'm walking past some screens, and there you are. There you and Corey Wooten with your polos on. I was like, where were you guys at? Were you at a real? Where were you?
Actually, we've done it the last couple of weeks, so every once in a while, they'll take me out of the studio and I'll go out. And it was Izzy. It was actually Israel Adonijay.
We
go
out
to these Miller Lite Brewing Views. And this past Sunday, we were at Timothy O'Toole's.
Okay, so right down the street. Yeah,
this is, I believe, the only one that's actually going to be downtown. Most of them are going to be kind of surrounding suburban areas. Like, actually, this week is going to be out in Elgin where the Miller Lite Brewing View is going to be at. So I'm flying back from Salt Lake City. I got to be in Utah this weekend. I've got the USC at Utah game Saturday night. So I've got kind of a quick turnaround flight. And the weird thing is the quickest route I could get back, because Salt Lake City doesn't do a whole lot of red eyes as far as just flying direct overnight from Salt Lake City to Chicago. I'm actually going to fly from Salt Lake City to New York on JetBlue. So I'm bypassing Chicago, flying to New York, and then taking the first thing spoken from New York to get back here to Chicago, landing at like a quarter after 10. So out in Elgin, I'm just going to go straight from O'Hare to Elgin.
Oh, that's
to the
easier.
Brewing View.
Yeah.
So that will at least work out well with the location this week.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Before we get into Bear, since you brought it up and you travel, I saw me and the wife were watching college football and we saw the way that the mountains hug. I think it was BYU, but it may have been
in
Utah. I feel like that is the most beautiful, outside of Colorado, which I really like too.
Yes, yes.
That's the most beautiful backdrop for football. It just felt like, man, this is some This is Pac-12. This is mountainy football, and I was here for it. So what's the most picturesque place that you've been to cover a college football game?
It's Fort Collins, where, well, you know what? It's difficult. Either Air Force or Colorado State. I'm going to go with Air Force, though. And maybe a little bit of that is just the nostalgia of the stadium and there with the service academies also. But the whole state of Colorado and the football institutions there, I mean, you go into Colorado, and it's hard not to be impressed with the snow caps in the distance and, you know, just these picturesque sort of vistas that surround the stadium, and to be in the broadcast booth and to be calling a game, and then whether it's in a commercial break or, you know, if there's just some action that slows down on the field and you look up and you look out, you're like, wow, this is really impressive. And it's not lost on me anytime I go out there, partly probably because I'm coming from the Midwest, mm-hmm. where things are so flat here. And then every weekend during the college season, I'm flying out west and I'm seeing these different venues. And even somewhere like Washington, you know, when you're in Seattle and you're at Husky Stadium and you look out from the stadium and Lake Washington is right there. People literally sail up to the stadium to go, and they call it sailgating, and they'll park their boat, their sailboat right there outside the stadium, and they'll tie it up to the buoy or whatever dock or whatever, the pier they got out there, and then they go straight in the stadium from there. So it's very unique, the settings that they have out west when I'm doing these Pac-12 games. And it's fun and it's different. Then I get to come back here and get right back into Chicago mode with the coverage around here. So it's fun.
What's the Rose Bowl like? Because I hear people talk reverently about that too.
The Rose Bowl is the magnitude of the stadium is very difficult to match with other venues because it's just so damn big and it's pretty. And it could it use, once you're really kind of getting into the nooks and crannies of the stadium, it could use some renovation. There's no doubt about that. But when you know the history of the place and you step into it and it is so massive and is just perfectly cylindrical in its shape going around. And like the last time I was at the Rose Bowl was, well, you know what, maybe I've been there since then. But the time that's sticking out to me is when Iowa played Stanford in the Rose Bowl a couple of years ago. So I was out there covering that game, and that was obviously a great assignment for me as a former Hawkeye. Stanford ended up trouncing Iowa, but it was just the venue itself, and it was the first time in a quarter century the Hawkeyes had been there for the Rose Bowl. And so for them taking on Stanford and playing in that game, and all the Iowa fans that were in the city and that were in the stadium, the pageantry of it is very difficult to not just sort of get washed away in because you know everything that's taking place at the Rose Bowl there. So in stadium, as far as the Pac-12 goes, There's not another stadium itself that feels more reverent than the Rose Bowl. Now, while UCLA, especially where their program is right now, it's not necessarily the most, you know, vibrant atmosphere.
Right.
When you're talking about the crowd, the energy in the building, that will go to like an Autzen Stadium where Oregon plays or Husky Stadium where Washington plays when the Dogs are good. They got a really good kind of active crowd there. So there's a few other spots that certainly outrank, but just the stadium itself and feeling the weight, the gravity of the stadium and the history there, the Rose Bowl is very difficult to match.
Best tailgate?
Oh, you know what? I've just started because I do my Ant Bite stuff where I'm traveling and I'm on the road. So this year there's been a couple of stops where I've actually, my producer sent me out with an ENG just with a handheld camera. We've done a little bit of tailgate footage beforehand. I've really taken advantage of the possibility of tailgating very much because some guys you work with, I'm sure you got different people who have their different habits. The play-by-play guy I do most of my Pac-12 stuff with, Roxy Bernstein, he likes to be at the stadium like a good 4 hours plus beforehand, you know, gets his laptop set up, gets all his stuff laid out, and he goes, interacts with the media and the other press in the area. That's not necessarily my thing. Mm-hmm. I'm usually more of a, unless I have some sort of a pregame responsibility, if we're doing like a talk back, a live via satellite sort of deal with the folks back in the San Francisco studios, or if we have to pre-tape something. If there's nothing I have to do pregame, I'm not looking to be there more than 2 hours before kickoff. To me, that's just a lot of sitting around. I'm comfortable in the hotel room. I can get on my pre-production sort of work, finalize, get my head shaved, shave my face, get my suit on, make sure I'm suited and booted properly. I'm not in a hurry to get to the stadium early enough to do the tailgating thing, except for now we've started to roll in a couple of Ant Bite segments where I'm out there interacting with some tailgaters beforehand.
Arizona State is
Yeah,
thing.
It is.
It's very different. You go to tailgates like in southern venues, and you kind of know, like, that was the first time where I was like, wow, their menu is like the menu of what you tailgate in Arizona is a little bit different than what you would do in Tuscaloosa. Uh-huh. I found it fascinating, and with that place, I so hope that they can make that stadium what they want it to be, because the location of it is perfection. It's basically right, a stadium built into a mountain.
Yeah, it's really cool. And that's, like, to me, there's some Big Ten atmospheres that are a little bit underrated. Like, you go to East Lansing when Michigan State's good. That's an underrated atmosphere there at Spartan Stadium. You know, their crowd is into it, and they're loud. And because of the construction of the stadium, it gets real loud, too. There's just a lot of metal throughout the stadium in the way it's built. So, like, Michigan State is an underrated Big Ten atmosphere. Arizona State is an underrated Pac-12 atmosphere, because the crowd, for the most part, usually shows up, especially when the Sun Devils are good. And while they're there, you know, whether it's because it's usually one of the top party schools in the country or whatever it is, by game time, and most of their games are going to be in the evening or later in, you know, Pac-12 after dark kind of action. So folks have had an opportunity to really get their game faces on, you know, leading into it. The crowd is good and sauced up by the time the game happens, because it's so hot there that they're not going to do any 11 o'clock kickoffs in the middle of the day when it's 100 degrees outside. They're usually going to be in the evening where folks can really get their pregame in by the time kickoff happens. And when kickoff happens, the crowd's ready. And they got a nice atmosphere. I would say that's one of the underrated Pac-12 vibes on game day.
All right, so we've had the nice discussion with Anthony about different places that you should go. You're right about I've been thinking about making the trip to either Colorado State or Air Force. Mm. I've been
it's
thinking about it.
It's
because
definitely worth it.
You know, I got a thing for mile high cities.
Okay.
So I kind of we've been knocking them off the list.
Yeah. Have you ever been to Laramie, to Wyoming?
I've never been to Laramie, but I have one of my boys from high school, Julian Hooker, used to play for out there at Wyoming, and he used to talk about how there were no speed limits back then, and that they would. Is it Fort Collins that's closest to Laramie? Like, he said, that was like the next biggest city, and they would drive the hour sounds and a right. half or whatever.
I'm geographically challenged, but it sounds right.
To Fort Collins to make it all work. So
it's like the Autobahn out there. Once you get out there in kind of cowboy country, and there's just nothing but space and opportunity, and it's like you and one other person on the road within 10 miles of each other, the speed limits are fairly non-existent. So it's fun. If you don't mind having a lead foot and you can really put your foot down behind the wheel, it's a fun place
to drive.
You
got some people with you so that you're not getting, you know, bored on the drive.
Yeah, preferably.
That's probably. But it's on the list. Have you been to the Army-Navy game?
I haven't, no.
It's on my list, too. And I say it every – Anthony, I say it every year.
Yeah.
I go, that's something I want to do. I just need to just do it, because it just looks – awesome.
Now, by the time you get to that point in the year with your schedule, though, where you got some hoops going on and everything, like, do you have time to kind of make that work if you want to?
It's a hard thing, like, because especially now with the show on Sunday, like, that's like an Anthony Heron-esque turnaround that one would have to do, like the one that you're going to do this weekend. Let's talk about what you saw on Sunday, and it's Anthony Heron. You want to follow Anthony on Twitter? It's Big Ant Heron. You can ask him all these questions. He will really, really like it. And you can talk to him about all the different foods that he tries with his Ant Bite segment that he does on Twitter. Just if you just look up hashtag Ant Bites, you'll see a lot of the stuff that Anthony has been doing at different college stadiums around the country. What did you take away from Sunday's loss to Miami?
I felt like it was, oddly enough, I viewed it in a lot of ways as a step forward for Mitchell Trubisky, because the game against Tampa, while it was nice to see him throw with accuracy and make a lot of big plays, there wasn't any real legitimate physical pressure on him during that game. And the defense, especially the secondary for the Buccaneers, has just been so horrendous throughout the season that there really wasn't a lot of mental pressure on him in that game either. So it was nice to see him have that full-on, full-fledged breakout game against the Bucs. But then you transition forward to a couple of weeks later. Now we're back to what you could consider, you know, legitimate pressure football. And not that the Dolphins are the steel curtain, but it's a secondary, at least, that can really cause you some problems. They made a lot of plays. They came into that game leading the NFL in interceptions. And especially once you get down in the red zone and in the confines of where the routes have to be really crisp and the throws really have to be on time, or you're putting the ball in jeopardy. And so to see him be inaccurate on some deep balls early in the game, to see the offense be scoreless at halftime, and to see him have to respond to that and to start to play some good football, in the second half. And he responded in a way that's important for him to be able to respond if he's going to continue to go in the direction that, you know, all Bears fans are hoping he's going to go. And some of us are starting to believe more that he will go, that the physical tools are part of it. And I've talked to you about that a lot with him. That's such a finite portion of the equation for the great quarterbacks. You know, Aaron Rodgers to me is the rare breed that is immensely gifted physically, but then mentally is off the charts as well. And emotionally is strong enough to handle all the chaos and all the voracious nature of the defenses attacking you throughout the game. Aaron Rodgers is just the unique deal who puts the mental and the emotional and the physical together at as high a level as you can. A lot of other guys are going to be off the charts in one, maybe at max two of those areas. So for Trubisky, where hey, he's above average physically, certainly not Aaron Rodgers physically, but let's say he's above average physically, we need to see the mental and emotional part of that continue to move closer to where his physical gifts are. And the only way to truly do that is to have to go through the fire. And quite often, whether it's been preseason or regular season, we've seen him get a little bit frenetic and get to where he starts to kind of clench up a little bit. And, you know, I mentioned this earlier on the station today that he's to me like the antithesis of Jay Cutler, where Jay seemed like Eeyore, where he could care less what was going on. His emotions were pretty much just going to stay low and level and have this sort of carefree kind of vibe to it. Whereas Mitch, he really does care deeply about wanting to be good, wanting to be great, and working really hard at it. But you see where that manifests itself into some emotional mistakes or into some erratic play at times. So the more he can continue to find, you know, kind of like John Spartan, just to enhance his calm in those moments and just to play within himself and to trust his eyes and to be on time and in rhythm, then the more steps he will make. And it was good to see him in the second half the other day make those types of strides where he seemed far more calm and collected in the second half than he did in the first.
That's a quality Demolition Man reference right there from Anthony Heron. We're going to take a timeout. We're going to talk more about Mitch. I got some questions I want to ask him about Mitch's development and what happened to the defense and why Brock Osweiler was able to get hit. Well, we know, yak yards. We'll discuss that with Anthony Heron coming up next here on The Score.
Here's the snap. Trubisky going to throw. Trubisky looking. Guns it over the middle. The pass is intercepted in the end zone. Big play. They broke on it. Threw it with a safety over the top to Broniker. Saw it coming. T.J. McDonald on a swipe.
That highlight courtesy of our sister station, WBBM News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. This hour is being brought to you by Menards. Save big money at Menards. A texter, because Anthony Heron is here in the building, and he made an excellent Demolition Man reference. Texter says, did he just say John Spartan?
You remember in the movie that, like, you know, you got Sly just coming out of the ice, and he's full on Sly Stallone at that point, and he's like looking to knock people's heads off, and he's looking for weaponry and everything, and he knows that. What was Wesley Snipes' name in the movie?
Simon Phoenix.
Simon Phoenix is just running rampant through the streets of whatever futuristic town they're in, and every once in a while you got Sandra Bullock coming in like, enhance your calm, John Spartan. I want to enhance my damn calm. I'm Sly Stallone. So that's one of the lines in that movie that sticks out to me.
Was it knitting? Was that the thing that they had programmed into him?
There was knitting.
That he used to calm down?
What else was it? There was a couple of songs in the movie that they would play, like Sandra Bullock and Benjamin Bratt were needy in the movie too, and they would like sing these little jingles as they were driving around about Armor hot dogs and stuff like that, and they were very, very bubbly, and it was a contrast to Sylvester.
You know what I didn't realize, because I made the mistake of mixing up Judge Dredd and Demolition Man on Twitter. Shout out to my man Sam Fells who pointed it out for me. What I didn't realize was that Rob Schneider was in both movies with Stallone.
So that's obviously the mix-up.
And so it completely, like, messed me up.
Right,
completely messed me up.
But it validates a reason why. I mean, it's a futuristic cop movie with Sly Stallone and Rob Schneider.
Correct.
How many of those could there really be?
Apparently two.
Apparently.
And can I just tell you that I don't know if you've seen the Taco Bell commercials with Josh Duhamel. Where it's like, what was it? The nacho fries commercials.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Those are outstanding.
Okay. You know there's a scene where there's a marquee.
Okay.
And in the marquee, there's a cookie. And the cookie, yeah. It makes mention of John Spartan.
Does it really?
It's like John Spartan is up for commendation or something like that. And I was just sitting there going, oh, this is very meta what they're doing right now.
Well, how about within Demolition Man where it's the Schwarzenegger Presidential Library? And back when the movie came out in the 90s, it was laughable.
Right.
But who knows, like 10 years from now, the governator could be the presidator or something.
Well, if you go back to Predator, you have, what, two governors and a guy who ran for governor.
Wait, who was the guy who ran?
Sonny.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know Sonny, that.
Sonny Landham ran for governor of Oklahoma, so a.k.a. Billy in Predator.
Yeah.
So you had two governors, like two actual governors. And I think someone tried to convince Carl Weathers to run for governor, too.
I might vote for Carl.
I would, too. I still, like, it makes me laugh. I explain. See, again, going down the rabbit hole. But we'll get back to Bears in a minute.
We will. We got time.
So Predator's on Saturday morning.
Right.
And I'm down watching it. And my wife.
The original.
Yeah, the original.
All right.
And then my wife is like, what are you doing? And I'm like, have we ever, as a couple, sat down and watched Predator? And she's like, no, we have not done that. And so I was telling her about the moment. I went into the whole thing. They got you pushing pencils, you know, with the the high five where they're
right,
showing
where they're
off the
flexing
bike.
And veins everywhere. Yeah.
I said, you have to watch this movie with me. You have to. And she's like, I don't think that's going to happen. And then right after that, Alien versus Predator came on. Huh. And I was talking about how important that movie is because it's the first time really that a black woman led a sci-fi franchise. And those are two major.
Yeah.
And I go down this wormhole like all the time with the actual history with Alien. It's so fascinating with all of the movies that have come on after it. And you find out about Weyland Industries and there's a whole history to it. It's super great. All right. I'm going to stop geeking out right now. We can go back to geeking out about football with Anthony Heron. Let's talk about what happened to the defense on Sunday.
Actually, I just saw one thing. The reason 224 text, or I said 10 years from now about Arnold would be because by then some potential laws could be changed. That's why I'm not talking about like 2 years from now. 10 years from now, by a certain point, if Arnold continues to be Arnold and be in the political sphere, then maybe some laws are changed by then. I do understand that right now because he's not a United States born citizen, that he would not be able to run for president as of today. Just to address that one text.
All right, so back to the defense.
Yes.
What happened? Oh, wait, you're a Jets guy. You play for the Jets?
Briefly. I played for the Detroit, Green Bay, Atlanta. Yes.
So Matt Forte told me that at his time with the Jets, that the visiting team was always in the sun at that stadium. And that they had to figure out ways to try and shield him. And you saw the Bears doing this on Sunday where you got guys walking around with planks trying to keep the sun off of guys' face. How real is being in the sun while playing football, 85 degrees and humidity?
It's such an enormous task, especially when your body has not recently been conditioned to it. It would be one thing if, you know, if that game were the season opener, it would be the same level of arduous task for both teams or you're coming out of camp. But there's enough heat and humidity here in the Midwest where, from a conditioning standpoint, your body would be ready to handle that. But with the last couple of weeks, the temperature drop here in Chicago, the Bears coming off a bye week, you go down to Miami where it's 100-ish degrees with immense humidity. And that, as much as anything, it's one thing to battle high temperatures and sunlight, but it's really just when the air is soupy, it weighs down on you at such a level. And, you know, what surprised me as much as anything was not only were the linemen, the defensive linemen are usually, you know, me as an old D lineman, we're usually the first ones affected by that, because while the position of D line is the least mentally taxing position on the field, it is the most physically taxing position on the field, because you are there wrestling with the ginormous offensive linemen, quite often two different blockers in different various settings. Then after you do that in the manner that they know where they're going and you don't know where they're going, and you have to react and you have to try to stop their force against your will, Then you got to chase the ball from there as well. So it's extremely physically taxing. The D-line is normally the first and main ones affected by that. But you saw linebackers and defensive backs. I mean, the Eddie Jackson play where, yes, he just flat out quit on the play afterwards. And part of that was just the mental and physical exhaustion that was there at that point. Running backs on both teams needing to come out of the game at key moments in the game because they were just so worn out by the conditions on the field. So it is a real thing. Like right now, I'm roughly 250-ish at my heaviest. I was around 290 and just, you know, guys on the field much bigger than I ever was at this point, just trying to carry that amount of weight around. And regardless of the type of physical condition you're in, if you're at your peak, it's just hard to play a sport like football. And the Dolphins ran like 75 plays. That's by far the most snaps the Bears defense has had to play at any point in the season. So I said it on from the Miller Lite Brewing View. I was talking to Izzy, and it's one of those things where it can sound like an excuse. And part of it is, but it's also explaining why, because you're coming off the bye week and the temperature and humidity conditions are very different than what you've been experiencing over the last few weeks. Then you add in the fact that just snap after snap is being compiled throughout the game. And by the time the defense gets to the fourth quarter and overtime, they are just gassed and drained, and they've been chasing all these short routes, all these quick passes. And that's part of the genius of what Adam Gase did. And you know, you would think the Bears had to be prepared for it. They knew that with the diminished offensive line of the Dolphins weren't just going to, hey, backup, Osweiler, Brockweiler, get him, seven-step drop, snap after snap. No, they were going to quick pass, but it's one thing to know it's coming. It's another thing to physically stand up against some run game, batter you a little bit there, and then just the tennis match of running and chasing the ball sideline to sideline over and over again and how that adds up throughout the game.
I thought Gase did a great job with his game plan because you're talking about a guy, he got the first team reps, I want to say on Friday, that they probably knew it was going to be him instead of Tannehill,
right.
But he pared that game plan down to, we're going to run Frank Gore, and we're going to throw these wide receiver screens, we're going to flip the tight end, we're going to run it on the left side this play, we're going to run it on the right side on this play, and it worked. And I think it worked primarily because of what you're talking about. You had that extra added advantage of playing at home in the heat and the humidity, and that's why you get 268 yards after catch for those guys.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the Bears had been one of the best tackling teams in football, according to Pro Football Focus, through the first month of the season. And then Sunday, they missed 19 total, 15 tackles missed in the second half and overtime. That's as many as they had missed through the first four games. So just second half and overtime the other day, they missed as many tackles as they did through the entire course of the season before they got to Miami on Sunday. So that just shows you the Bears didn't suddenly become soft. They didn't suddenly become bad tacklers. They did suddenly walk into Miami, and I don't think Eddie Jackson was out at Ybor City the night before. I just think they went
Tampa
up there and got
– Tampa.
What's Miami? South Beach. Let's go with South Beach. I don't think he was out hanging out at South Beach the night before. I think they got out there, got gassed, and even – you think about a moment. Even in a loss, like Akeem Hicks making that stick on the goal line and forcing a fumble, as exhausted as he obviously was and coming off a timeout – there was something, there were moments that were positive to me to take out of that game where you say, you know what, Khalil Mack didn't have his best game, but it was nice to see, okay, if Mack wasn't making the play, Akeem Hicks, when it was needed to save the game. And for that moment, one of the Bears' best players saved the game by just de-cleating a blocker who was trying to base block him in the run. And Akeem Hicks just got his hands inside, slung the guy to the other side of the offensive formation, and then just lit up the running back, Kenyon Drake, in the backfield. And Drake still was able to take another couple of steps, but he's staggering while he does it. The ball just drops out of his hands because of the way Akeem Hicks lit him up. Those are to me still moments that will resonate as the season goes on, because you do have tangible evidence of players like that. Players like Akeem Hicks, who haven't necessarily been in a situation where the games have this level of weight to them. These games are important this season. Like last season, you and I talked about it a good bit, where it was all about development. This season, when that Khalil Mack trade was made, development's still important for Trubisky and for a young roster, but wins matter this year. Trading for Khalil Mack says, we're in our window now. Now the window has begun. We're certainly on the very front end of it. There's a lot of contracts here where you got some talented guys who are going to be around for a few years, But we're now in the window, so these wins and losses matter in a way that they wouldn't have before that trade.
That's why I said going into the week, and I talked with McNeil and Parkins about this on Friday, I felt like that was a big game, that was a game you needed to win. And the reason why I felt that way was you're feeling great. You should feel great. After the thumping of Tampa, I mean, you beat the snot out of those guys.
Right.
You win this game against Miami and you're 4-1. It allows you a mulligan for this week. It allows you to, no matter what Tom Brady and Gronk and everybody else does, you get to go, we're 4-2. Mm-hmm. We're still in a great position to win this division. But you lose that game, and now you have the specter of Tom Brady and Josh Gordon and Gronk and Bill Belichick knowing that he has pretty good success against younger quarterbacks coming in, and it could end up putting you into a bad spot from a season standpoint from that one game.
3-3 is looming. You know, from 3-1 and hands down first place in the division to coming off the bye week, 3-3 is potentially sitting there, you know, with the Pats, who just for me and a brain fart, and folks pointed out on Twitter afterwards, where we're all used to New England winning Super Bowls in the postgame show. I even referred to them as the defending Super Bowl champs because they just, you know, like half the time this century, they've at least been in the Super Bowl, if not won it. But yeah, Philly special, I know that all happened. They didn't win this past year, but it's the New England Patriots. And so, yeah, I don't think any of us would go into this game, even if the Bears would have won in Miami, would go into this game thinking, well, it's a shoe-in, the Bears are going to win it, because it's the Pats, and they're starting to get their game on. And they had a nice shootout, slugfest type of game with Kansas City. They come out the victors of that one. But overall, the Patriots coming to Chicago and all the reasons, the ingredients you reference for why it could potentially be a difficult matchup for the Bears, 3-3 potentially looms after that hot start that they had and feeling like they could have and maybe should have won the first four games. Then you could be sitting there after six games at .500 and you have to recollect and regather yourself if that's the case. Still a lot of ball to be played if that happens. But again, this is where the building blocks of trying to put a real franchise, a year-in, year-out competitor in place, these are the moments where Matt Nagy will need to continue improving. And Trubisky and the roster and all the youth continue to improve and realize that moments like this are going to reverberate throughout the rest of the season.
I want to talk more specifically about how the Bears can try and beat New England. And I'm going to do that with Anthony Heron after a quick timeout. We appreciate it. This is nuts and bolts football talk when we're not talking about Demolition Man.
Yes,
Predator.
We're not talking about Predator.
Big Ant Heron is in the house. I'm Lawrence Holmes. You're listening to The Score. The bottom of the hour is being brought to you by the Chicago Wolves with their 3 first round and 3 second round draft choices. The Chicago Wolves are positioned to be the last team standing. The Wolves host arch rival Milwaukee Sunday at 3 at Allstate Arena. First 1,000 fans receive a free GameWorks gift card. Anthony Heron is here with me. He is one of our experts here at The Score. You can watch him on Fox 32. You can watch him on Pac-12 Network. He does an incredible job flying across the country, breaking down football for a living. It's a pretty good job, especially when you're good at it.
It's difficult to consider a real vocation. It is quite a bit of fun. It's not something I anticipated being for my career at this point years ago.
What were you thinking after you were done playing?
To buy a yacht and retire somewhere to some beachside community. I was anticipating making like 13 Pro Bowls and being a Hall of Famer and, you know, having my tens of millions of dollars stacked away nicely in a bank account somewhere offshore.
Offshore,
you know?
Caymans.
Yes, of course. Yes, of course, the Caymans. And that part, you know, didn't work out to the extent that I had anticipated. So said, you know what? And I'd actually started tinkering around with this after I was out of the NFL and I started playing and then coaching arena football. And so while I was doing that, where the NFL is just year round, you know, just sludge through the mini camps and OTAs and everything you're doing in the offseason, then of course the regular season. So NFL is a year round gig. Arena football is not. And I was recovering from some knee surgeries in Nashville with the arena team I was with down there. And I just started calling some high school games and then calling some college games between Nashville and when I was with the Falcons. I still had some media connections there. And just kind of year by year, while I was still actually playing and then coaching arena football, and the Big Ten Network started up. So then once BTN started up and I sent my reel that just somebody put together for me from some of the stuff I'd done in Nashville and Atlanta and sent that to Big Ten Network the first year they were around. So then they offered me a full slate of games in year two. So I did an audition for him in that first spring. I called an Iowa spring game, and that went well, and did interviews. And, of course, my Hawkeye folks treated me well. So in that second fall at the Big Ten Network, I had a full package with him. And so I said, well, I guess this is my job now. So I've just continued to find other avenues to kind of pursue things on television and radio in the years since then.
In the last couple of weeks, we've seen the Patriots offense roll, start to get rolling. How, when they're like this, is there any way to slow them down that you can see with the personnel that the Bears have?
Well, obviously the best recipe is if their pass rush looks like it did through the first four games of the season, more so than it did this last game in Miami. Now, and I don't know, maybe you've seen a more recent update. Has there been anything more definitive on Khalil Mack's ankle that you've seen?
Just more testing,
yeah,
which makes me nervous.
Right. And to me, the way that Mack was used throughout the second half and in overtime the other day, where not only was he very ineffective as a pass rusher, but it got to the point where the Bears basically turned Leonard Floyd into the more featured edge rusher, and Khalil Mack was the one spending more time dropping in coverage and chipping on inside slot receivers and things like that. So, you know, you would think, my guess would be that part of that was just them recognizing, not just resting him, but recognizing that, yeah, his ankle is gimpy right now. He's not that effective at this point as far as getting after the quarterback. And Leonard Floyd, to me, actually, and one of the texters even asked about Roquan Smith, in defeat, to me, it was the best game that both Roquan Smith and Leonard Floyd have had this season. I thought Leonard Floyd was very active, even in the snaps where he wasn't trying to DDT tiny wide receivers, but it was his most active game of the year, even in rushing the quarterback and picking up phantom penalties. So while he certainly wasn't Khalil Mack, he played his best game of the year, and I thought Roquan Smith did as well with his willingness to approach the line of scrimmage with more urgency in the run game and meet blockers and meet running backs. So all that being said, to the question you asked me about trying to contain the Patriots offense, best case scenario is from all four angles with your down defensive line, you're getting some pass rush. But I'll operate under the thought that maybe Khalil Mack is still going to be somewhat limited physically and that Leonard Floyd will not, you know, suddenly turn into Khalil Mack. So let's say that they're not necessarily getting the edge pressure they're looking for. Still on the interior, because of Tom Brady being a vertical escape quarterback, whereas some quarterbacks tend to escape either vertically or horizontally, like Mitchell Trubisky is more of a
horizontal.
Yes, he's a lateral escape guy. Lateral escape guy, Russell Wilson, right. Tom Brady's going to climb the pocket when pressure's coming at him. So the thing that's most effective, and, you know, we think back to the Super Bowls where, you know, Michael Strahan had great games and everything, but it was because of the interior pressure that the Giants put on him in the Super Bowl, or that, you know, the Jaguars can put on him when they face Jacksonville. It's interior pressure against Tom Brady that is the most effective because of where he likes to escape. He likes to climb the pocket while keeping his eyes down the field. After he climbs, he may try to extend the play a bit, moving laterally from that point. So Akeem Hicks having a big night, that is the most vital thing. Even if Khalil Mack is healthy, because of, you know, schematically what the Patriots are likely going to be able to do, whether it's using Gronk, Sony Michel, with their offensive tackles and just giving Brady an extra beat to get what's likely to be more of a quick passing game, you can try to neutralize the edge in a wider variety of ways than you can the interior pass rush. So I anticipate seeing, and, you know, Sony Michel has played really well lately, so I don't think we're going to see the majority of the snaps defensively being sub, but when they can put New England in some more predictable passing scenarios, when sub is on the field, it needs to be Akeem Hicks and Roy Robertson-Harris. It needs to be guys who penetrate with more effectiveness than what you get from maybe an Eddie Goldman, Jonathan Bullard, you know, some of the guys who maybe get out of their stance well but aren't as crafty as getting skinny in gaps, because you want pressure immediately in the face of Tom Brady. That gets him back on his haunches that much more and makes that, even the quick passing game, more difficult to try and execute for him.
What things scare you about the Patriots offense that are not named Tom Brady?
Sony Michel, and he's a back.
He runs so hard.
He runs really hard, and he's got the all-purpose skill set to him as well. Like, even when he and Nick Chubb both went to Georgia at the same time, like they were both in the Army All-American Bowl that I've been calling for NBC for years, and so I've been watching Sony Michel and Nick Chubb and all these other great backs that Georgia always seems to have since he was back in high school. He's just always been an injury plagued guy, but as soon as he got drafted by New England. I said, all right, that guy's going to have a shot at making some Pro Bowls because as long as he's healthy, he's got the full array of skills to him. I mean, at some point, if Lewis leaves New England, and Sony Michel can be that receiver out of the backfield too. He's got that type of game to him. Right now, he's mainly kind of their downhill thumper, but like Zeke Elliott, where he's got thump to him, but he's also got the route running skills, and he's got the soft hands more so than you would see from a lot of other running backs. So I'd say out of anyone, when you're going past just the names on the marquee like Brady and Gronkowski, the nation is starting to get a little bit more of a sense for who Sony Michel can be in the National Football League. And he's a weapon I think New England is going to start to unleash more and more now that he's really – and it's a complex offense they run in New England. So they seem to usually, with younger players, kind of just piecemeal them into certain roles here and there. But Sony Michel's been warming up for New England here lately. And he's the type of player that can put Roquan Smith and Daniel Trevathan in binds because of how he can be utilized. It won't only be sort of, you know, slot receivers that Roquan's going to have to worry about. You know, that's not a position the Bears are looking to put him in, but there's going to be times where he's going to have to match up with the backs. And Sony Michel is very, very effective with his skills to be able to come out of the backfield and route people up.
How confident are you that if it comes down to it, Mitch and the offense can do what Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs did to run with the Patriots if it turns into that type of game?
I'm not extremely confident. I want to see more of the Bears offense being able to operate at a high level. I'm feeling better about it. I'm not there yet because, you know, this will be to me just another, and even though it's not going to be, you know, one of the games in the national window, Sunday night football or Monday night football or anything like that, but it's the Patriots. And so it's New England coming to Chicago, and it's Mitchell Trubisky looking across the sideline and seeing Tom Brady and Bill Belichick over there, and it's him spending the entire week preparing for, and it's not that New England's defense has been stellar throughout the season, but you know that Belichick will usually have some sort of a trick up his sleeve, especially like you referenced earlier, for younger quarterbacks. So this to me will be another hurdle, just like facing Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay on opening night was a hurdle for him, just in what the perception is of him as the face of the Bears and their franchise future star and all that, matching up against one of the faces of the National Football League. This will be another opportunity for him to prove his worth against a team with Tom Brady, with the GOAT as the quarterback of the opposition. So for him, I want to see if he can respond to that. I've liked what I've seen throughout the last couple of games. I'm a tangible evidence guy. And to me, one thing that I want to pay attention to as well is Matt Nagy as a play caller, because I feel like there's so many times where, because he and Mark Helfrich put a lot of cool stuff together during the week, and it's almost like he wants to get all of it in every game as opposed to just saying every once in a while, I'm going to just call something more basic and trust my playmakers to make a play. Trust my offensive line to move somebody. Trust Jordan Howard on the inside zone just to defeat a blocker and get the yardage we need. Some of those things that he started to do during the second half and overtime, I'd like to see more of that as opposed to, you know, every time Kevin White comes on the field, it's because he's going to be lead blocking for somebody on some outside play.
You picked up that tendency too, huh?
Yeah, it's like you know they're not throwing him the ball. He's in there to basically be Orlando Pace outside the numbers at this point.
He's done a good job blocking. I got to give Kevin White some credit. I really have appreciate how physical of a blocker he is.
Yeah.
That's not why you drafted him, but at least you are getting.
It's a role that he's filling and filling effectively.
I think that that's a very cool thing, but we started counting. Like we were sitting there, me, Alex, and Matt, and Lance were sitting there like, oh, Kevin White's on the field, run play.
Yeah.
I think we were 6 for 6 on plays where we knew that he was on the field. Uh-huh. Like, oh, it's going to be a run play.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes 22 dive is the best play.
Is good enough.
Although I will say I would have preferred on the third down before the Cody Parkey.
Yeah. The third and fourth, just give him a better chance.
Right, just get a little bit closer. You don't have to try and go for the touchdown there, but but maybe you roll Mitch out, you cut the field in half, and you tell him, you can't take a sack, and don't throw an interception. But if you got Taylor Gabriel or Allen Robinson open on that play, hit him. and let's get this, let's make this a 48-yard field goal.
And to me, on something like that, on a bootleg or anything along those lines, Mitch is athletic enough where if you take a loss on a play like that, it's on Mitch. It's not on the play caller. But, you know, we think back to a couple of weeks ago, and I've referenced this on the air over the weekend in our post game. There was a point, and I think, you know, we saw the surly side of Matt Nagy a little bit after the game where, who knows, maybe he's going to be a little bit more guarded with the media. Maybe not.
I hope not, because I really enjoy listening to him talk about football.
He's been a fun listen post-game, really just anytime. He's been very open about it. But one of the things he said a couple of weeks ago was that there's going to be times where he protects Mitch during the game, and he's not necessarily going to say anything to him. Mitch may not even notice it. But that, to me, is what that was, where I agree. I would have liked to have seen a less conservative play call at third and medium with a chance to try and get your kicker in a more comfortable position for a game-winning field goal. But that, to me, was him protecting Mitch from the potential of a costly error, a costly mistake. I agree. I would have liked to have seen him do something. Not even, I don't know if aggressive is even the right word, but just something that suited the moment better than another inside dive, an inside zone play. And I think it would have put Cody Park in a much more comfortable position like Miami was able to do.
Anthony, I appreciate your time. We looked at the schedule, so the next three Tuesdays, we seem to be in the house.
Let's like make it happen.
That's what we're going to do. Looking Anthony Heron is one of our experts here at The Score. He's terrific, whether he's on my show or he's on Bernstein and McKnight or just calling in, talking with anyone else. You should check him out on Fox 32 after you check out NBC Sports Chicago. Also check him out on Pac-12 Network. He is incredible, and I'm glad that he's on our staff.
And looking forward to some information I'm not at liberty to announce yet.
Secrets.
That will be announced in what seems to be the very near future. And another gig that's going to be in the hopper that I'm looking forward to.
So I like that.
Yeah.
Anytime you're involved talking more football, I'm all for it. We're going to take a break. I want to talk some more about this, the Bears and Trubisky and the Patriots. But there was something I saw this morning online that I wanted to talk with you about, too, that I think that you might find interesting. I'll tweet it out at Lawrence W. Holmes, and then we'll have a discussion. Back after this on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.